You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here is your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
Well, good Monday morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek in Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Sarah Welkbeenham from Pataskala, Ohio, and you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for Monday, July 6th, episode 3989 by Worm Flooring. Good morning, horse world.
Well, as you hear, Sarah's here for her first time co-hosting this show. Hey, Sarah.
Hey, I am so happy to be here.
Thank you for doing this. I really do appreciate it. Sarah's a podcaster, so her sound is terrific because she has a good mic. So
the one that Glenn recommended.
So coming up today's show, we have travel expert and author Darlene Newman, our old friend, who's joining us to share insights from her new book called The Revolutionary Road Trip. Very well timed. It's all about the American Revolution, and it's the 250th anniversary, which you all heard about over the weekend, and which we heard very loudly on Saturday night here at the farm. I'll talk you to a little bit about that. Plus, in our post show, we're going to talk about your equestrian first world problems. It's that time of the month.
Well, happy birthday, America!
Jamie's out in Colorado. She's doing her annual trip out there with the family, helping out at the ranch out there. And so I asked Sarah to fill in today. Sarah's been a longtime listener and a friend, and she's an author and a podcaster. We've known each other for a very long time. Sarah, I should have asked you to do this long before this, but...
I know. Well, you know what, Glenn? It's never too late, right? And I've been a guest, oh gosh, a couple times now.
You were just on a little bit ago, weren't you?
Yeah, and I was just on a few weeks ago for the post show. And I've been on the main show. It's just been a couple of years now, maybe a year or two, but I've been on a couple times as a guest, so.
Well, and I also feel like we really know Sarah because we've cruised with her a couple times on the cruise.
Well, Glenn and I basically spent like two straight weeks together because we were at the American Horse Publications Conference, and we spent, you know, what, three, 4 days together there. And then it was like 2-3 days of not seeing each other and then like a full week of cruising together. So
that's right. It's fun. We had a good time.
So much fun.
So Stripes the Zebra. Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. I was watching this actually kind of unfold the last however many days that they've been, you know, posting about him and kind of everybody's like, oh, how much is this horse going to sell for? You know, Zebra. But my God, I don't think I expected it to be close to $100,000.
I expected this. Well, we did the show on Friday and talked about Stripes. It was up to $17,000 on the online bidding, but to go for $96,000.
Well, and I looked it up because I was like, how much do zebras actually normally go for? So apparently, according to the internet, between $7,000 and $17,000. So that $17,000 was already right at that cap normally, you know, and they say depending on age and training, but $96,000 is like, I mean,
well, it was
that's
bought
insane.
By a, apparently it was, from what we know, it was bought by a prominent private collector and exotic ranch owner, excuse me, from Texas. So I wonder if it's the same guy that owned a giraffe that got a loose. That's what I'm wondering.
It could be. It could be. And apparently Texas is the largest hub for private exotic wildlife and ranches, which I had no idea. But that's, I mean, I can't imagine they're going to do anything but like,
well, this,
you know,
was a riding zebra. I mean, this was a very well-trained
zebra. It's a nice zebra.
Yeah.
And they say that that's like a really rare thing, too, that most zebras are just like generally not trainable, very trainable, which makes sense.
Well, we've had Dominique from Zebras or Us on our show for the last probably 15 years. And, you know, we talked to her about, you know, should people be buying zebras and stuff? And I was kind of wondering how she felt about all of this. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to her and we've been chatting, but she did post this on her public page. She said, couldn't be happier to see this. These people put more hours into this zebra than most folks have worked. This is very impressive, but shows what proper handling can accomplish with a good-minded zebra. Major congratulations. So she thought that this was very impressive and she was very happy for the people who put all the time and effort into training the zebra, which you got to think about, right?
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, it was oil money probably that.
And they, and I was like kind of Googling around because I was like, what are they going to do? I mean, obviously they can like ride the zebra, you know, they can do fun things with it. But I'm like, but what? I like, you don't normally like take the zebra to like, you know, these major competitions. No. So apparently they can make a pretty penny for taking these zebras to movie sets and things like that. And this zebra especially, oh my God, can you imagine what they can do with a zebra that's this tame? So I'm sure that between that and maybe breeding, you know, they've got ways to make their money back.
The first time we met Dominique was a long time ago. We went to Norco, California for a week to do shows. Excuse me. And she lived there at the time, and she had her zebras, and she did movie work. And so we went to visit her at her farm. They were filming a commercial there with her zebras. So we got to see how all that was done visiting her that day. But yeah, it was interesting to watch. There must have had 30 people there just to film a commercial. They had the craft services and the whole thing. So Dominique has a lot of experience doing movies and things with her zebras. But yeah, congratulations to the winner. And more importantly, congratulations to the person who did all the training and got paid off rather handsomely.
Seriously, I hope they got a good cut of that, because they are the ones that deserve it. And also, I really hope that whoever bought this zebra, I mean, Stripes, come on, guys, let's rename the zebra.
So now let's talk about the other big story from the weekend is the crazy truck pursuit with the horse trailer and the horse in it. So this guy steals a truck and trailer. And I don't know if you got to watch the video.
Yeah.
But he steals his truck. Where is it? In Texas, maybe? I didn't see where
King County prosecuting.
I didn't look up exactly
where it was either.
But, California. It was in California. Yeah. That's right.
California.
So this guy steals his truck and trailer. It's got a two horse, you know, trailer, and there's a horse in the trailer, and he takes off. Well, it gets reported, and the police go in pursuit, and he takes off, weaving in and out of traffic with the trailer. At one point, they both went airborne. The truck and the trailer and the horse. And finally, the video that we saw from the police cruiser, they called off. We didn't see exactly what happened with the truck and trailer, but they called off the pursuit, but they did catch the guy.
Yeah.
And then they went up and opened the back door, and the horse just standing there like, what the hell happened?
Honestly, not even as sweaty as you would think. No. And he really kind of, like, the way he turns around and looks at the guy, he's like, yeah, I don't think that's my mom driving, but something weird's happening here.
Yeah, something weird. I don't know if that horse is ever getting in the trailer again.
He should have been more, he probably could have been way more shook up than he was. He was just kind of like,
It was crazy. It was nuts.
Yeah, it was wild.
We've done a lot of weird stories, as you know, on this show over the last 15 years, 4,000 episodes, but we never had that happen. That was a first.
Which kind of surprising, honestly, although I'm sure people steal horse trailers all the time. But
not with the horses in them.
Not usually with
going a high-speed chase.
That didn't seem very smart of him, but that's...
All right, let's talk about, I don't know how all of your fireworks evenings were, but we must have gotten a new neighbor here at the farm. And we live in a neighborhood with farms that are 5 to 10 acres. So they're all 5 to 10 acres, mostly horses. But right over our barn, over the trees, over the barn, over the pine trees, right there at the corner, I don't know who we got as a neighbor, but they must have spent $10,000 on fireworks.
Oh my God.
So our horses, we weren't sure how James is going to be, Jennifer's new horse. But, you know, Scooter and Nigel, they lived at a farm that had a gun range. So they're kind of used to that.
They were all right.
Difference was, and what freaked our horses out on the 4th, was you could see the fireworks.
Oh, no.
You could see them clearly over the trees. So they weren't too bad when the sounds were off in the distance, you know, distance fireworks. But these were really loud because they were right there and you could see them. And that freaked them out. And of course, freaked James out the worst. But even Scooter was a little freaked out.
I mean, they can see them. That's a different thing than if they just heard them in the distance.
And you know, it's not the boomy ones necessarily. Yeah, that freaks them out for a little bit. But they tend to calm down a little bit with more of those. It's the sizzly ones, you know.
Those are sketchy.
Oh, that got them.
And I feel like I live in the country, and so you can hear people, either neighbors or like you can hear 3 different counties shooting fireworks off. But I mean, this year was like next level.
I mean, we got a free show. It was right there. And this guy, it was a private, we don't live near a town. There was not a town. It's just a neighbor. And his finale was as good as any town's finale.
Oh, he wasn't playing around for America's birthday.
No, he had to have spent $10,000 on fireworks. It's just crazy. And, you know, they went on for 40 minutes.
Oh, my God.
So we had to go out and actually stand there with the horses because that James was just going to lose his...
Poor James. You're like, sorry, buddy.
I don't... You know, we talk about balloon training, Jamie's balloon training, and we did do some of that, but there was nothing going to...
Oh, that's not going to prepare them for this.
No, not for seeing the actual fireworks like they're in your backyard.
Oh, no.
That did them in. That was it.
Poor guys.
So anyway, that was our fourth. We got to enjoy a fireworks display while watching our horses melt down. And we were ones that were like, we're prepared for this. We're ready. Our two horses are fine. James will be fine. Nope.
No.
He was good. We did determine that he's a stress eater. So, you know, we put hay out for all of them, good hay, the good stuff, hoping that would, and it did work for Scooter. And James, we determined, is a stress eater. He'd go over, grab a bite, and then be chowing down at 90 miles an hour while watching the fireworks, and then go grab another bite. And so he's definitely a stress eater, which is probably why he's getting a little fat.
Might be time to back off those calories. Maybe a ration balancer
for him.
Everybody
picks on me about my horse. All right, let's do some daily winnies.
Scooter's gonna look
skinny. From the podcast to the barn, here's some hidden birthday wishes to keep you warm.
I have one auditor birthday, Ariel W. Happy birthday to you,
Happy birthday. Ariel. Woo!
And here, you get to do your first one.
Oh. Well, you know what, Glenn? I'm going to have to do multiple ones, you know, because you haven't had
Jamie
me on
replacement.
Yet. I know. I was like thinking, well, who can I shout out to? And I put one down and I was like, oh, wait, I've got another. Then I put another one down and then I put a third one down. So you guys get all kinds. So my first shout out is to my buddy, Heather Wallace, who, of course, is also a podcast host on the Adulting with Horses. But and Ashley Winch as well, because these two ladies, you know, I've been friends with them for years now. But just in the last maybe couple months, I've gotten to know them even better. And, you know, we were at the AHP conference, like we've talked about together and things like that. But I applied for a job, a staff writing job with the Chronicle of the Horse, which is a huge, huge publication. And I was talking to the girls about it, you know, at AHP and then on the cruise. And they have just been so sweet and supportive. And actually, I had told Heather that I got the position and I hadn't told Ashley yet, and I had just totally forgotten. And she sent me a text and was like sending me all these congratulations. And apparently Heather had told her. And so anyway, you guys are the best. And so I'm shouting out to you, but I'm also shouting out.
Congratulations, by the
way. I know. Thank you.
We weren't a listener back then, but we used to do a regular segment with the Chronicle where they would come on and get magazines out of their archives from like the 1950s.
Oh my God.
And they would go through what was happening in the magazine. And we
legendary.
We did that every month. Like we'd do a different magazine from history.
Oh, cool.
And it was so cool to hear about what was happening back then, you know? It was really cool. So congratulations.
Yeah, they're so iconic.
The iconic, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of people I had to beat out. So I was kind of like, oh, do I even attempt to apply? You know, and I've been freelance writing for years professionally now, and I've written for some pretty major people, but you know, that's still a kind of a next level. And so anyway, those girls were just my little ride or dies throughout the whole process. And so, they get a huge shout out. And then Amy Walrath, who was on the cruise with us, she, as I tell, you know, Glenn was telling me the last time I was on, you know, you don't talk about your books as much, and I probably should. But so Amy was one of the ones, we were sitting in the solarium on the cruise, and Heather and I are talking about book stuff, and Amy looks at me and goes, wait, you have books too? And so, bless her little heart, she goes and immediately buys three, like right then and there. And then she has now shouted out on her social medias like two or three different times. First, when she bought the book, and then after she read it and loved it. So, Amy, you rock.
Yay.
Thank you. Yes. And then my last shout out. So, if you guys haven't heard yet, the Adulting with Horses podcast has officially announced a cruise. So, this is your cruise PSA, which I will obviously be going. But these girls, so I was on the cruise with Heather, and I was joking around with her when we were talking about planning this. And she said that her and Natalie already kind of had it in the works. And I jokingly said, well, if you're going to plan it for next year, maybe plan it for August because that's my birthday month. Totally joking. And sure enough, it's in August. So
I was wondering why they planned a cruise to the Caribbean in the hottest time of the year. Now I know it's your fault.
That's because it's my, yes, it's my fault. It's because those girls are the best. And maybe it worked out for them too. I don't know, but that's okay.
Check out the Adulting with Horses Facebook page to find out more details. They did ask me about it, for everybody wondering. We officially announced that the Alaska cruise was our last official Horse Radio Network cruise. And they asked if they could pick it up. And I'm like, yes, please. That'd be great. So they're doing Glenn the planning now. Now, if I go, I'm just going.
You know? That's right. Yeah. You just get to hang out. You're along for the ride. So, and it is, there's obviously going to be
a
lot
more
women. It's a four-night,
too, so it's doable for most people to get a barn.
It's a little easier. And I know people have already been asking, like, well, are husbands allowed? I think Natalie's exact words were like, we'll find a place for them to sit or something. I found funny. But yeah, so it is both, although I think there's going to be a nice vast majority of ladies. So if you're I think Nate's going to want to hang back for this one because he already knows what he would be getting into with me going on a cruise with these girls, and he'd be, you know, along for the ride. So I will personally be going as a ladies cruiser. So if you're like, oh, well, the husband can't go, you will not be in alone. You will be in good company of others, probably just going solo. So.
Well, as you know, we have an author coming up today, Darley, who's been coming on our shows for 18 years now. And I do pick on you because you don't advertise your books as much. So tell us about your books.
Yes. So ironically, I finished my seventh book, which is the second book in my newest series, which is my Wellington romance series. But I finished it on Friday. So
I was
really excited
about this. By the way, is having known you for a while now, you're very fun, but I don't think of you as a person writing romance.
Yes,
you're my just personality. You're kind of a tough chick, and your personality doesn't kind of match the romance. Where did that come from?
I've always enjoyed romance books, and I want to kind of blame like the Twilight Saga era because I was 18 or 19 when those books came out and then the movies. And honestly, I used to like all, I was a huge reader as a kid, and I did read a little bit of romance, but I read a little bit of everything. I read a lot of like suspense books too, which is why none of my romance books have just straight romance plots. They also have to have like a mystery or suspense or thriller elements because I can't seem to write a romance book without them. And also I think that it's just kind of boring if it doesn't have that. But I also like to think that my romance books are probably a little bit unique because, you know, of course, my female main characters are badasses somewhere in the horse world somehow. You know, they've kind of got to be. So I love to write about that, like, you know, the strong female lead character, and then they end up, you know, falling in love. But I definitely like to keep my books interesting. So
so Natalie used Ocala as the setting for her books. You used Wellington. Did you spend some time in Wellington?
Yeah. So my first book series, which is called the Impelled series, that one is primarily set in Ocala, although parts of those books are set in Wellington too. But the second book series is just set in Wellington. So when I was younger, when I was in my like early to mid 20s, I was a showgirl. I went to school for equine business. And so I went down and did an internship as a showgroom in Ocala first. Oh gosh, I was there maybe 6 months. I was there for a whole winter. And then years later, I decided to work for Farm Vet. So I ended up helping them run the Farm Vet trailer in Wellington for
right
the season.
The
and then I did, yes, right on the showgrounds. And then I ended up doing one at Hits Ocala too. So I had a lot of time I spent in those two places. They're two of my favorite places. And so when I went to write my books, I couldn't think of anywhere else I wanted to set them because, of course, I have to have horses in my books, you know?
You know, so. It's funny. We talk about the Wellington feel that when you go there, it has a feel to it.
It does.
And people that haven't been there have no idea what we're talking about. Until you go, you don't really understand.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, Jennifer and I could visit Wellington for 3 or 4 days at a time, but then we had to get out. And I don't know how to describe why. You know, you get it. You've written books about it now, but it's just different.
It is. And I kind of approach the books. I mean, every book is different. So that Wellington series, there it's an interconnected series, but each book has like a different couple and a different, you know, subplot or, you know, whatever's going on. So the first book, I made it where the main character is, she works at a farm called Beckett Equestrian Center. And it's one of those big, huge, fancy, you know, traditional Wellington farms. And essentially she has to fake date the billionaire boss's son in order to get what she wants, which is a promotion to manager. And of course, you know, this is a romance book. It's it, like legit, right? Yeah. And so what I wanted to kind of include in that book is a lot of that, like behind the scenes of, and even kind of behind the scenes of like the upper tier of Wellington that maybe most people would be like, what's that like? Well, the cool thing is I got to see a lot of that behind the scenes when I worked for FarmVet. I still remember we would have to deliver stuff to like Kent Farrington's farms, like in those gated communities and things like that. And, you know, and I got to go kind of behind the scenes a little bit on the showgrounds. And so I wanted to kind of include that stuff in my books of places that they had to go, because it was just such a unique experience. And I kind of wanted people to feel like they were immersed in that. And so I included a lot of that. Obviously there's some scenes, you know, where they're other places, but a lot of the times they're at like Wellington International, Palm Beach International. And so that's, you know, of course, you know, they fall in love. It's a romance book, you know. And then the second book I put out, so how it's interconnected is so the main character in the first book is best friends with the main character in the now second book, and then, you know, they meet new people and we kind of get, basically it's kind of like girls at a boarding barn situation where you know, once the two people get together and, you know, she gets all the things, now this is kind of their home base is this Beckett Equestrian Center. So that's kind of where I'm revolving the interconnection of everybody. You know, new people coming in and meeting new people, basically female characters for the future of my probably many, many books in this series. So the second book, I wanted to do something a little bit different. And I honestly think this is the best book I've ever written. I was pretty excited when I finished this one. So this one, I decided to have it be a equestrian journalist as the main character. And obviously, I know a lot about that, considering I am an equestrian journalist, although I've never been one in Wellington. But so I decided to have her be somebody that would kind of look into a century-old mystery, which of course has to involve horses. And how it starts is that she goes to this remote island. There's this herd of wild horses. She finds some things that I won't tell you what they are, but basically it leads her to realizing there's this deep mystery and secret that's been buried for many, many years. So ended up being that this subplot was, oh my gosh, it was so much fun to write. But the way it unveils, it ended up being even kind of more complex than I originally planned. And it turned out really, really fun.
And this one comes out when?
Probably in about a week. I actually finished it on Friday, but I have some things I need to tweak and I'll be out of town part of the week this week. So I would say maybe late, not this week, but next week I should have it out. But I have the cover already done. So I will post, actually you guys would be the first people to see it. So I'll post it in the auditor group so you guys get the first sneak peek of the cover too.
All right, sounds good. And yeah. What's the name of the first, if they want to read the first book in the Wellington series, what's that?
Yes. The Wellington Ruse is the first book in the series, and then the second book will be called The Wellington Heir.
All right, I'll put links to that in our show notes as well. Congratulations on finishing your seventh
Thanks.
Book.
Yes.
Well, speaking of books and authors, we need to get to our guest. Right after this word from Worm Flooring, we're going to speak with our old friend Darlene Newman. Worm Flooring now does your trailer roof. Leaky roofs are a common problem in horse trailers and RVs. Worm Flooring's revolutionary silicone-based coating creates a barrier against the heat and wet. First, it seals your roof to stop leaks before they start. Second, it reflects back nearly 90% of those nasty UV rays, keeping your trailer or barn up to 60 degrees cooler on a blistering day. So ditch the duct tape and buckets. Invest in a long-lasting peace of mind with Seal and Chill. It's applied by pros for a flawless finish and is only $7.50 per square foot. That's a steal for a cooler, drier, happier trailer or RV, which means happier horses and happier people. Head over to wormflooring.com now to find a dealer near you. That's WERM flooring.com. Well, we welcome back to the show one of our dear friends, and she's on for a reason because she has a new book that came out, and she was just on the show here a little while ago in the Where Are They Now segment. Darlee Newman, and you'll remember her from the Equitrekking fame, and she's over there on PBS, and she has a new book out, a well-timed book called Revolutionary Road Trip. Hey, Darlee.
Hey, Glenn, and hey, Sarah.
Hello.
Darlee, you've been on TV and all over the place with this book. Good job.
Thank you. I'm excited. I mean, you know, it just came out. So it was literally, it hit bookstores on June 30th. So definitely time for the 250th and July 4th.
Well, you know what? It's so fun for us when we see our old friends, you know, do new stuff and it becomes so popular and you become a number one best-selling author on Amazon. It's so cool. It's just so cool for us. So congratulations. And we also know what it's like to stick with something for a very long time. And that isn't easy either. People think that's easy. It's not easy.
It is not easy.
Oh, no, definitely. But it's, you know, it's so great to share stories and to write a book is, people are saying, oh, wow, author. And I'm like, wow, it is a big deal. It takes a lot of time.
Say there's like a small percentage of people that actually complete books versus I think it's like 80% of people say they want to write a book. So if you write more than one, you're like in the point like 0.000% of the world.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just so you know.
Cool.
So good job, Darlee. You did it.
Good job, Darlee.
And to you, Sarah, because I think, Wow, you have a lot of books out.
Just soon to be seven. Seven is in about a week. But yes, anything more than one, you are in that under the 1%.
All right, get to work on the next one, Darlee.
It's just that easy, right?
Yeah. Cool.
So, Darlee, Revolutionary Road Trip. Tell us about it.
Well, so it's, you know, Hidden Stories of America's Founding Journey. I spent the last 6 years traveling to sites related to the American Revolution for my show, Travels with Darlee. I was filming for my PBS series and literally I'm visiting battlefields, national park sites, churches, homes, plantations, places where history was made, the founding history of America. And I found so many stories that weren't published that I decided to put them in a book. And so the book, it's not only a book to tell these stories, but you can actually visit these sites. You can use the book two different ways. I mean, you could just read it and learn or listen to the audio version that's coming out, or you can actually use it as a guidebook.
So are these all taken off your show Travels with Darlee, or is this is there a bunch of new stuff in here?
There's new stuff, and the level of depth is I went into a lot of detail. It's funny when you're writing something, and I went to all these places and I interviewed all these people. So it's the experts on the ground at these locations who know so much, but. Again, found information that hadn't been out there and wanted to put it together. So you're definitely going to read it and learn a lot, I think. And I'm excited because I've heard from a lot of people who've been picking it up and saying, I didn't think I was interested in history or this type of history. And I thought it was interesting. And I'm like, oh, that's my job is done then.
Definitely. And it's so well-timed. I think a lot of people are getting like into American history just this year because it's the 250th. So I think a lot of people are going to kind of be like looking into that stuff right now anyway.
It's a great time. Yeah. Because what I found interesting too in writing this, so I mix in, you know, there's sad stories. I take you to Camden Battlefield with a veteran and military historian in South Carolina and walking along, you know, this hallowed ground. It's very important to kind of internalize, but to hear Rick Wise, who was a veteran, share about this battle and what happened and, you know, what it means today is really interesting. But then I also take you to like Princeton University where, you know, there's a battle that Alexander Hamilton was involved in. And there's this great story of whether or not he fired a cannon that could have gone through Nassau Hall and decapitated a painting of King George II. So it's a mix. And then, of course, I take you to the colonial taverns and pubs because, you know, Glenn. Because it's Darley.
Because Darley has to, if Darley doesn't eat on a trip, it's not a trip. It's not.
I know. I mean, people want to know where they can go and eat and drink. That's true. And actually, there's so many cool places. I just had a New York Post article come out where they interviewed me about the colonial taverns that our founding fathers were drinking at. And I was like, this is a great topic.
That's so cool.
You know what's, I only got the book last night. Thank you for sending it over, because you know I love history and I'll be reading every word of this. But I did read most of the first chapter, and I was really surprised or had forgotten how much New Jersey played into the war, like an integral part of the war.
New Jersey has a lot of stories. I mean, again, I couldn't even put everything I found in this book. There's so much more. New Jersey was a crossroads of the American Revolution. I've filmed a lot of content out there and done a lot of research on New Jersey. And by the way, their state archives, which is not in the book, but it is in my episodes, which I'm dropping on my YouTube channel from Travels with Darley. So you can watch these. You can go see the video versions of some of this as well. But their archives is fascinating in New Jersey, where they are housing like rare documents from America's founding. So yeah, New Jersey has a lot to offer, Princeton and beyond.
Yeah, I was, you know, we all know about the infamous crossing of the Delaware and all that stuff, but you know, I'd never thought about it being so involved. And then the other thing is, you did manage to get some horses into the book.
You know, it's so funny because, well, I did equitrucking for many years. And by the way, that you can watch it now. I don't know if you all know Up Entertainment. It's out of Atlanta, but they've got equitrucking back on. So okay. If you want to subscribe to Up Entertainment, you can watch the original seasons of equitrucking. But I purposely wasn't covering horses when I first started doing Travels with Darley, because I thought, oh, I should differentiate this show and that show. But then in every season, I'm horseback riding now.
Of course.
I'm back in the saddle. And of course, there's marsh tacky horses. The Carolina marsh tacky is a rare breed, and it's so interesting. Roots with South Carolina and the Carolinas. And these are horses that were used throughout history, including during the American Revolution. And I went out and rode them in the Camden area. There's also information about them at the National Steeplechase Museum, which I visited in the book and in the show. And so interesting. I went out with the Carolina Marsh Tacky Association. They are safeguarding and helping to promote this breed, which is endangered. But when you get out on those horses, they are so hardy. We went literally into the woods, kind of like off-roading on these horses. And I was thinking, wow, these horses helped America basically throughout our history, and how valuable that we still have them today. So I thought that was really interesting as well.
And there's not a lot of them, is there?
No, there's only a few hundred. They're critically endangered, and they're trying to get their numbers up. So the Carolina Marsh Tacky Association is working on that, and they are very, you know, invested, obviously, in getting their numbers up. But then also, if you go to Brook Green Gardens, which is in my Myrtle Beach episode, which is my hometown in South Carolina, they have some marsh tacky horses there, because they actually have heritage breeds of horses and chickens and all these different animals there, goats, which I thought was really interesting, because people just need to be aware of these breeds. They're really special.
When you were doing the series and writing the book, what surprised you the most about the American Revolution?
I think the diversity of the people involved and the stories that just are often underrepresented. I mean, we all think about George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and the founding fathers. And I definitely cover that in the book and in doing my research. But there's so many people that are just left out of the stories that had important roles, and they're just ordinary people. And looking at, you know, the homes that were taken over, I visited a number of homes, including at Princeton Battlefield State Park, the Clark home, which exists today and was taken over and used as a hospital during the time period. But going into these places, it really gives you a different appreciation for what happens when there is this American Revolution, this war that changes the course of American history. But it really changed things for ordinary people quite a bit.
Well, you know, I saw a YouTube show on that. It's funny you mentioned that. I saw a YouTube show on that the other day about the forgotten people at home. So these soldiers, volunteered to go fight for what they wanted to fight for, right? Their new country. But then the wife and kids were left at home running the farm. you know, whereas, you know, the husband was the one doing most of the farm work.
Left at home and in the cities too. I have in the Charleston chapter at the Hayward Washington House, there's some insight into the women and this family that was left. It was the women and children left to kind of fend for themselves. And what happened is the British took over Charleston itself. And, you know, how scared people were. So it was a pivotal time for many ordinary people. And that's, and then there's a kind of a funny story too. It's not funny, but it is in Delaware. This another home where they had a council of war during the revolution, and both sides were pillaging all these homes and places too. And this one family had all of their cheese taken by the troops, and they had like stored all this cheese. I just thought it was kind of a funny, it wasn't funny for them, obviously. No. It was like their livelihood, but I was thinking about all that cheese and I was like, what did they do with all that cheese? I guess they just ate it right away, full stop.
Well, that's the only way they could feed the army, right? They had to pillage everywhere they went, both sides. You know, it wasn't just one side, it was both sides. You know, supplies were the biggest problem back then. And of course, horses came into there too, because they had to haul the supplies.
Oh, yeah. Horses were always stolen too from both sides. I thought that was pretty interesting to think about. But yeah, going through South Carolina and the interior part of the state and kind of seeing the terrain there, wow, you have a whole new appreciation for what the soldiers had to contend with as they navigated it, but then also what the horses had to contend with and why they wanted these Marsh Tacky horses who, you know, were more used to that, the terrain and the swamps and all of that.
You got to spend some time where I grew up in Pennsylvania. Of course, we went to Gettysburg all the time. You know, Jennifer and I have been to Gettysburg 100 times. And you think about Gettysburg in terms of the Civil War, by the way, you know, the anniversary of that was the last couple of days of the Battle of Gettysburg. So what you managed to go to Gettysburg and find a connection to the Revolutionary War.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a gem. If you're ever in Gettysburg, obviously the National Park and the battlefield, you have to visit. But then if you're there, you should go to the Dobbin House. It is they have it set up as a colonial tavern, and there's an inn there as well. And you can go drink Rumbelly's Vengeance, which are very strong, punchy punch drinks. But it's so neat. And there's multiple different areas to dine in. There's even a downstairs kind of bar pub area. And it just, you really feel like you're stepping back in time, and the amount of history that has taken place. This home has been around since colonial times. Gettysburg was not, you know, the site of a battle during the revolution, but there were people that were living in the area. It was sparsely populated. And it talks about, in the book, I talk about the reverend who, you know, had this as his home, used as a school for a time. And now it's this colonial tavern. And I think it's just so neat that it's being preserved, and it's been preserved over all this time.
You know, another place, because Route 30 went through there, and that was one of the main highways from east to west. So, you know, that was always, you know, main thoroughfare. And York was too, and you got to spend some time in York. Did you get to Valley Forge at all?
I did not, no. You know, I kind of left out some of the places would. Yeah, because I feel like they've been done so much, but there are untold and lesser known stories that all of these sites, including Valley Forge and every place you would think about. So that's what's interesting about this. And I also found it really interesting that they're learning so many new things at these sites all the time. They're doing archaeology. They're looking back at records. They're in Delaware at the John Dickinson plantation. They've recently, in the last few years, uncovered an African burial ground, an African burial site on the property that they were trying to locate. So there's new information coming to light all the time. And I think that's really interesting, because people think about it being in the past and that we know what happened. We know the history, but we're still learning it.
So you obviously did equine trekking first. How many years? That was a lot of years, right? You did equine trekking?
Yeah, many. I did it until 2012. So it was a long time ago at this point. But I started in 2007. So
really, yeah, that was long before YouTube.
You know, talk about early online video. Yeah. I was some early online video.
You definitely were. Were you always interested in history, though, or did that kind of develop because of equitrekking and just being out around the world?
You know, it really developed through travels with Darley. So even later than that, like, I didn't think I was that interested in history, to tell you the truth, because growing up and learning it just by reading a book, I was like, oh, this is okay. But by traveling to these sites over the last many years and visiting and meeting people on the ground, I have really come to love it, honestly. And I think it's so, again, it's so interesting to be able to go to these places. They talk about the power of place. I mean, when you're standing in these battlegrounds, in these historic homes, and you're meeting people who it's their life's work to not only preserve these places, but then to share the stories, it's really, really, I think it's so fascinating. And there's just so much to learn. I mean, I've been taking a deep dive into the lesser known sites and stories from the Revolutionary War, but you can never even learn everything. It's just, I find horseback riding is similar though, because you can always improve, you know, you can always improve with horses, and it's the same with history. So horses and history have that in common, I guess.
Well, and I didn't know you were from Myrtle Beach. We went to Myrtle Beach all the time as a family. And then Jennifer and I have been to Myrtle Beach. We were there when Hugo hit, actually.
Oh, I was there when Hugo hit. I lived there at that time. So that was wild. Yeah.
We got kicked out. We were in one of the campgrounds on the beach, and they kicked us out the day before. Thank God, because that campground got wiped out. But we went deep sea fishing 2 days before, and it was the wildest ride I've ever had on a boat. It, we were out in the ocean and the waves were huge. We caught more fish that day. half the people were seasick in the back. And we were just riding the waves, catching fish. And we should not have been out there.
That was huge. That was a huge storm.
Yeah, that was one of the worst I think that ever hit Myrtle Beach. It was bad. Well, yeah. Darley, good luck with this. We're so happy for you and so excited for you.
Thank you. Yeah. So the book is out now, and it's in bookstores. You can find it on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Walmart, wherever you want to purchase a book. Please pick up a copy. Support an author.
Yes, support an author.
Revolutionary Road Trip, Hidden Stories from America's Founding Journey. I'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. What's next? Are you just continuing with Travels with Darley, or do you have something extra planned?
Well, we are filming our 100th episode season right now. So I'm out on the road. I just filmed another Revolutionary Road Trip themed episode up along the Hudson Valley in New York, up at West Point.
Oh, yeah. You would have to go there, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Yes. And so, again, I'm continuing to cover this history and then also other places. I'm heading to North Dakota to the Theodore Roosevelt National Park this summer, hoping to see some horses out there, Glenn.
you sure, certainly will. Well, yeah. This is great. Well, thanks, Darley. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Glenn.
Celebrating 20 years of proven performance, Cavallo hoof boots aren't just some passing trend. I know we've used them probably for 15 years of that 20. The boots are built by horse people for horse people to provide real traction and shock absorption on mud, pavement, and rocks. I know when we were driving Scooter, we were driving in the first place we lived, we drived on all macadam, and we put his boots on all four, and we used them for every drive we did around that neighborhood. They give your horse the confidence to move freely, making them the ultimate tool for trail riding, barefoot transitions, rehabilitation, or driving horses that bolt. The best part, Cavallo boots are a breeze to use. They're not complicated to put on. It's one of the things I liked about them as a horse husband. They're easy to measure, easy to fit, and they stay secure. They don't twist around like some of the boots do. So at the end of the day, Cavallo is an investment in your horse's happiness and long-term soundness, and they last a long time too. If you want a happier horse and a better ride, ditch the hassle and choose the brand that sets the global standard for hoof health. Head on over to Cavallo-Inc.com. That's Cavallo-Inc.com today to find the perfect fit for your horse. They have complete charts on there, how to measure and how to do all of that. Follow those and you'll get the boot that fits. And that I'll put a link to that in our show notes as well, so you can go find the boot that will fit your horse. You have been dealing with something I want to talk about today, because everybody knows how that I've had chronic Lyme disease for 20 years since Lyme disease started. I always like to be first, Sarah.
of course.
Yeah.
But setting the trend.
You have your horse. Tell us, it's Letty, right?
Yes.
So Letty's what brand of horse?
She is a not-the-truck thoroughbred. She is 11 this year. She turned 11 in March. And I've been jokingly calling this the Letty Lyme saga. And in fact, I was talking to some of the auditors when we were at the Equine Affair dinner meetup. I was talking about this at dinner, so some of you might have remembered this. And also some of my local people like Andrew and Mel, they know Letty really well. We all go to, you know, local horse shows together and stuff like that. And luckily they were there as well. And were able to kind of give me like a, yeah, you're doing the right thing situation where I'll get to that part. But essentially, Letty got Lyme disease, and we don't really know when, to be honest. It showed up as chronic on the test and even acute too. But for the last year, essentially, I was dealing with something with her that I just like could not seem to get to the bottom of. And it started, you know, in May, or maybe April of last year. Letty's a very sensitive girl. She's a thoroughbred mare, and she fits the stereotype. But she has always been, you know, she's always been very sensitive under saddle and not under saddle too. But and she's always been a little bit like, she gets excited, she might buck. She gets frustrated, she might buck. But I was having a problem where the bucking got not only worse, but just like, I could tell that it was like angry instead of like a, we am having a good time buck. And so at first it was kind of like, what's going on here? So we went ahead and injected her hocks, and that didn't do a whole lot, although they were dry according to the vet. And I spent all summer kind of trying to dissect what was going on with her. I got a new saddle, you know, it was wolf locked. It fit her like a glove. I did mesotherapy on her back because she was back sore. She was so hypersensitive. I mean, the list of weird stuff just went on and on, and I was doing everything in my power to figure out what was going on with her. And in November, it kind of almost came to a head a little bit where she was getting a little worse.
And they hadn't tested like for Lyme at this point?
No, it was kind of the strangest thing.
You live in Lyme country in Ohio.
I know. And I honestly, I kick myself now because I'm like,
what's wrong with the vets? They should just do that immediately.
I was really surprised my vet didn't suggest it. And I even had a vet, I actually shipped her to Lexington. I'm in Columbus, Ohio, but I shipped her down to Lexington for a month with a trainer I sometimes use. And she even had her vet out, and he's a great vet. And, you know, at first we almost x-rayed her back and didn't, and he ended up doing mesotherapy, and we ended up changing her diet and stuff like that too. And that helped, all of those things helped just like the tiniest bit, but it was just like, I kept just taking one step forward and like six steps back.
Did it come in waves too?
It did, and it was gradual.
She'd get better for a little bit, and then 3 weeks later, it'd be a new symptom.
Yeah, and I did like Adequan too. And I remember it was like these two magical weeks of like, I was like, oh my God, she's cured. And then like it was, you know, all the symptoms were back. And I think what happened is the inflammation might have just kind of lowered a little bit temporarily, made her feel better.
Well, and what happens with Lyme disease is the little critters in there that are causing the problems, they tend to go dormant for a period of a couple of weeks. They tend to wake up about once a month. And what happens is when they wake up, when they get active again, is when the spirochetes, when they get active again, your body tries to fight them, or in this case, your horse's body tries to fight them. And that's when the symptoms come out. So that's why you would see the symptoms really bad for a little bit of time, but then they would take a break. You know, to take a rest. And
which
then,
is so frustrating.
Yep, that's right. Because then you think, oh, whatever it was, I've gotten over it. But then it would come back with new symptoms. And that's the problem with Lyme disease, which is I still don't know why they just don't test for it in the beginning.
I know.
It's
and I know
easy. It's a blood test.
Yeah. And we did it like to Cornell. So how it ended up, and it was a blessing in disguise, I guess. So I had plans to ship her down to Aiken, South Carolina with that trainer that I sometimes use that's normally based in Lexington. And so I did. I shipped her down there. She gets down there and she just like blew up, like is the best way to kind of describe it.
But she was feeling terrible.
Yeah. And it makes sense. The long haul, you know, was about 8 hours. It probably just rattled her system, and she just never quieted.
Stress is what will wake them up too.
Yeah. Yep. And the trainer was like, well, I don't know. Her back's really sore too. Like maybe she has kissing spine. So we had this really awesome, he used to be a track vet. I mean, he's like down in Aiken. Luckily it was kind of, like I said, a really good thing that she was there, because I had so many people that that were just high end, you know, vets and things like that. So I had the vet come out, we x-rayed her back, and he goes, you know, this is normal remodeling for an 11-year-old off the track thoroughbred. There's nothing that should be pointing towards the way she's responding, because she was like, I mean, just like wired and in bronching, like, you know, every few steps. So sure enough, he looks at me, he goes, my money's on EPM or Lyme. So we tested her for both, because she did have EPM when I first got her. And sure enough, the Lyme disease test came back positive. We did 30 days of doxy. We did some, you know, like sucrophate and omeprazole for her gut and stomach. And she is like a different horse now.
It is 30 days work.
Yeah. And it took a while. And so kind of with the saga, and I was telling people about this, and this was in April that we had this meetup. So that trainer that was down there, and to be fair, you know, Letty had either just finishing up or just finished up the treatment. And it took a good another at least month before I started to see things kind of resolving.
And the little guy's dying.
Yes. And so she kind of looked at me and was like, I think you should retire this horse. Like, I don't think this horse is ever coming back from this. And so it was like, I mean, you know, I've had Letty since she was just turned 5. And so I'd had her for years and, you know, I love her and I love competing her and, you know, she's my girl. And so it was kind of traumatic because I had brought her home and I kind of went, I know this horse. And I had actually shown her in November when she had Lyme disease and when things were starting to already really come to a head. And she did buck me off in the warm up, but by God, she went out there and jumped clear rounds the rest of the weekend. And I feel so bad now because I have no idea, but you know, it was cold and slippery and, you know, one of those things where I wasn't really sure what was causing what, but I brought her home and I kind of just made the decision to just see how it went. So I just really slowly brought her back into conditioning. And now, I mean, like I said, she's so much happier, comfortable in her body. It is night and day. She's jumping courses again and she's doing really well. Although I told Glenn jokingly, she decided that she hadn't put me through enough PTSD recently. So I think she maybe put something out in her tail head or her lower back, scratching her butt on something.
James did that the other day too. It come so, back three-legged, but after a couple days, they're fine.
Yeah, I got to call the chiropractor and get that situated.
I think they do that. You know where I think they do that? Is getting up from laying down and rolling.
That very well could be. And she had a big chunk of hair missing, like on her little rump right above her tail. And she has, poor girl, her little skin is very sensitive in the summer.
This is such a thoroughbred mare.
And it's, yes. Oh my God, she is. I'm like, Letty, you're making the stereotype look like the stereotype. But she is. She's such a cool mare. And she just is so much fun to jump around when she doesn't feel like, you know, absolute crap. So I'm pretty excited that she's back.
And I'm glad to think how much longer you could have been dealing with the chronic thing, and then you would have never, then she would have never been.
Yes, better. But this is like a PSA because I mean, it's one of those weird things where the symptoms are so vague.
You're paying for a blood test anyway. Just get one
more. I know. Just get it. Seriously.
I don't get it, especially when you're in areas like Ohio.
Yes.
Are ripe with it.
Blown up recently.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. One of my best friend's dogs got Lyme disease like 2 weeks after I found out Letty had Lyme disease. It's all over the place. And I've been vaccinating my dogs for it for years, but that's something. Yeah. If you guys don't do that, that's
it's
not a bad idea.
You know, obviously this is one of my hot topics, but yeah, definitely. I'm glad you got it tested and that this got done, but it, you know, Lord knows if you had stayed in Ohio.
I think it would have taken a little bit longer. I'm sure eventually we would have landed on that, but I don't know how many more months I would have had that happen. So I spent a lot of money to get her to Aiken to play with Aventers. And while I did get to go down there, I went down for a few weeks, like every month for like 2.5 months. So while unfortunately I was not even able to ride my horse, but once, first time I was down there, I did get to enjoy Aiken. And I was just happy that, you know, we knew what was going on and that I was getting her recovered and that she even got this far. So,
well, good. I'm glad about that. I never have understood what, especially the people medical community has had against Lyme disease.
Right.
They just do not want to accept that there's even chronic Lyme disease or any of that out there. It's becoming more, you know, acceptable now, but that's mostly through legislation. States legislating that doctors have to treat it. It's the insurance companies.
It's painful.
I'm convinced it's the insurance companies saying we don't want to deal with this because it costs too much.
I mean, and our horses, like the difference I see in my horse, just even just looking at her when she's just standing,
yep,
just this, the comfort in her eyes, it is wild how much it affected her. So yeah, that's nuts that they,
so yeah, they, what I would that. Say, if you see weird stuff that they just can't figure out, tell your vet to do the test.
Yeah. And just it, why
they're
not?
Not always accurate either, but at least, you know, mm-hmm. you have a, I think the accuracy rate now in Lyme disease tests is 60 to 70%. At least yeah. you have a 60, 70% chance of it coming back positive, and you know, and then you get them to actually treat. And if they tell you 15 days of antibiotics, that's not long enough.
Oh, it's 30.
There mm-hmm. needs to be minimum of 30 now.
Yes. Yes. And we even considered doing, we did doxy, but the vet said, like, if we don't see enough of an improvement, we could also do, I think it was mesocycline. Yeah,
They'll do doxy for 30 days and then skip 2 weeks, like take 2 weeks off and then do a different one for another 30 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad it worked with the doxy. That's terrific. And
oh, yeah.
That's
because
you caught it not soon enough, but soon enough, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably about it could have been very close to a year. But the problem is that the symptoms, some horses just never show symptoms, but the symptoms are so gradual that it just kind of creeps up on you and you don't really quite.
They different can change for every month horse. To month.
Yes, totally different for every horse, which is why it's so hard to pin down.
And it's that way with humans, too. That's why it's so hard to find in humans is because the symptoms. Like, I never had some people with Lyme that have chronic Lyme have debilitating arthritis. I would have aches, but not that. Mine was mostly neurological, which is great for a guy who does podcasts for a living.
Yeah.
But, you know, thanks to Jamie for covering for me all those years. But, yeah, well, I'm glad about that. All right, you want to do some history?
Let's do it.
It seems like that's what our show's about today, actually.
It kind of does. I mean, it's a good thing.
So I kind of picked the stories today because I picked the ones that I knew Jamie would have trouble with. So
I thought, that's all right, I'll take them.
Yeah, Sarah won't have trouble with these, so I'll pick these. So on this day in 1559, during a grand equestrian tournament held in Paris, King Henry II of France, an avid and highly skilled horseman, entered the list to joust against Gabriel Montgomery. That was the captain of the Scottish Guard. Montgomery's wooden lance shattered on the king's armor and sent a massive splinter through Henry's helmet into his head. He managed to live for another week, but he succumbed to his wounds. And that was the end of royal jousting tournaments in France.
I mean, that would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So at that point, the new king determined, we're not doing that again. So, yeah, he apparently was a good jouster. But you know what? What a lot of people don't realize is they use the softer wood on the jousting lances. So they would splinter so that, you know, when they hit the chest or hit your shield, that you wouldn't have that full force there. There would be concussion, but the wood would splinter and take some of it away. Which makes sense until it splinters and goes through your helmet.
Yeah. and then you're scared.
Yeah. All right. Being from Pennsylvania, and you heard us talk about Gettysburg earlier in the interview with Darley, you know, we went to Gettysburg a lot. We learned a lot about the battle and things like that. Well, on this date in 1863, immediately following the Battle of Gettysburg, by the way, they have the best Civil War reenactment ever at Gettysburg
year.
Oh, it's thousands. It's great. But anyway, immediately following the Battle of Gettysburg, General Jeb Stuart's Confederate cavalry fought a series of brutal, rain-soaked rearguard actions against the Union cavalry at Williamsport in Hagerstown, Maryland, over the next 2 days. They had intense mounted and dismounted warfare, but the cavalry successfully held off the Union pursuit, allowing the wounded and retreating Confederate army to safely reach the Potomac River. So in that case, it was the cavalry that ended up saving the Confederate army to fight another day. Otherwise, I think that the war would have been over right then if they hadn't been able to get away, thanks to the cavalry being in between them.
Thank you, cavalry.
On this date in 1975, the most famous, highly anticipated, and ultimately heartbreaking... This is the one I wouldn't have done with Jamie here because she would have got upset. It was a match race happened on this date in 1975 between Ruffian and Kentucky Derby winner Foolish Pleasure. They went to Belmont Park and they did a match race. And for those that don't know, that means one-on-one. And more than 50,000 fans attended and 20 million watched on TV. I remember this happening. I was in high school in 1975.
Which was probably a lot for back then.
It was a lot for back TV. Then. And while leading ruffian tragically fractured both sesamoid bones in her right front leg and had to be euthanized. But this was also kind of the beginning of the end of match races. So because it was highly televised, I mean, this happened on TV.
And can you imagine today it would be
back then you had three stations, you had NBC, ABC and CBS. And so it was on one of those, probably NBC. And, so then they determined that it was match racing that caused this. They blamed match racing. There were a couple of match races after that. But not many. They didn't do many match races after that. So, yeah. So we got news stories today about the end of jousting tournaments in France and the end of match races in the United States. There you go. So that's what I have for today's news. And by the way, thank you to everybody who's given me feedback on the news segment. Apparently, people are really liking it. So we'll keep doing that. And thank you. Where can people find your books? Where can they find you?
Oh, yes. So I have my books everywhere. In fact, for those of you that were listening to me talk on the post show the other week, Amazon has realized their mistakes and came crawling back and said, we are so sorry. Our bad.
Oh, you're
Here's your account back. I'm back on Amazon, which was just in time. So actually, my books are everywhere now. I decided to stay what's called wide in the publishing world. So my books are on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, Google Play.
Do they just search your name?
Apple?
Or?
Yeah, they can search Sarah Welk Bainum and all my books will come up. But yeah, they are literally everywhere books are sold. I actually have them in libraries as well. So you can get them or request them from the library, those library apps like Libby and things like that too.
Very good. Well, thank you for filling in today. You did a great job. Good job,
Sarah. Yay!
And we're going to be back for a post-show auditor, so hang on for that. We're going to talk about your question, First World Problems. But before I do, I've been kind of following on Instagram Kelsey Fendler. Does that name ring a bell at all?
It does sound familiar.
She's a badass. Okay, so she is a rower, and she just set a record, men's and women's record, for rowing from California to Hawaii in her fancy rowboat. This is not one that you would think about on a lake. This is a very nice rowboat, but it's still a rowboat. And she rowed, she expected to break the woman's record. So the woman's record was 86 days. Rowing from California to Hawaii. And she ended up doing it in 43 days, 17 hours.
Whoa.
Yeah, which broke the men's record by 9 days.
Good for her.
So she has now got the fastest time there. She also becomes the youngest woman to ever complete an unassisted row across the mid-Pacific and the first American woman to do it. So she broke all kinds of records. It's 2,400 miles in 43 days.
That's insane.
And it was a 21-foot boat called Lily. And she got a mass following. She had Starlink, so she could upload videos along the way. And I don't know when she had time to do that, but she did all the time. And she developed millions of people following her. So when she pulled in to Hawaii, there was a throng. I mean, there was thousands of people to greet her at the dock. And she had bone-chilling cold. She had blisters on her hands, obviously. By the way, she's built like a tank.
No kidding.
She had sleep deprivation because you can't sleep when your boat's just floundering around or you're in the middle of a storm or something. You got to keep the boat moving.
Can you imagine trying to post that kind of thing too? Like that's, I mean, that's some.
I know. She had good cameras, GoPro for the wind. She had a freshwater crisis where her thing broke and she had major storms with high. It was crazy. But yet she did it. Now she's a whitewater raft ride. She's a whitewater river guide in the Grand Canyon. And so she did this to raise money for the Whale Foundation, which provides physical, mental, and financial support for the guides, the Grand Canyon guides. And she raised $180,000. So good for her. And congratulations to her. I know it had nothing to do with horses, but that's one badass woman right there.
Badass woman.
It was so fun to follow her on her journey, actually, and heart-wrenching at times. But But it was, I'm glad I came across her on Instagram. And you know, once you come across somebody and you watch the whole video, you see, oh, that's all you see. So,
yeah.
So I've gotten a lot of people trying to break records now on Instagram showing up my feed.
Oh yeah. You've totally changed your algorithm for at least a week.
Sometimes you want to though. I mean, sometimes you want to change your algorithm because if you accidentally watch one news story, then you get all the news again. And that's,
you know, sometimes I've been like interested. I know it's clickbait and I'm like, if I do it, this is all I'm going to see.
You're screwed.
And I'm not doing it. It's not worth it. It's not worth the click.
Now on YouTube, we try and change your algorithm occasionally and it's so hard to get YouTube to change your algorithm. It's so funny.
Yeah. YouTube is like set in stone for a while. That's true.
It's true.
But social media, you click on one thing and that's it.
TikTok. Oh my TikTok. God. If you watch one video all the way through on TikTok, you're screwed.
Don't do it if you're like, I don't ever want to see anything like this again.
If you're just a little bit curious, don't do it.
Don't do it.
No, you don't need to know that bad.
Those are your two PSAs for the day.
That's it.
Check for Lyme disease and don't click that TikTok video if you don't want to see more of it.